I think we understand that we all employ our imagination quite often. Children are specialists at using their imagination, but we all use our imagination anytime we are asked to contemplate or to understand something that we cannot touch or feel. We use our imagination. For example, if I say the word hot dog, immediately you've used your imagination. Something came into your mind. I don't have a hot dog sitting here in front of you. You can't look at one right now. So you use your imagination. Most likely, all of us used our imagination fairly similarly when it comes to a hot dog. That's pretty straightforward. Some of you may have thought in your mind of relish being on top of the hot dog, where mine only has ketchup and mustard. But aside from that, we probably all imagined pretty much the same thing when it came to hot dogs. We use our imagination for things we can't touch. But when things are more complex and when they become more abstract ideas, we go to a further end of the spectrum, because a hot dog, we've all experienced. We've all had hot dogs in our hands. That's why we can come up with a pretty concrete idea. But when you get to the other end of the spectrum of things that do not have any physical form at all, if they're only an idea we cannot examine, our imagination is a little harder to cohese around it in the same fashion. Well, God is in the category of things that we cannot touch and feel. We spent a lot of time in my last seminary class talking about this idea of our imagination is the way that we comprehend God. Because we cannot touch and feel Him, we must use our imagination. God is very much real, but He does not have a physical form. So unlike the hot dog, where we used our collective imagination, probably came to very much the same idea with God, oftentimes there's a lot of disparity between what is imagined when God is mentioned. If we ask the average person on the street to think about God, and then we ask them to finish the sentence, "God is blank," we'd probably come up with widely different fill-in-the-blank answers. I wonder what kind of answers we'd have. Some with a church background might respond with something like, "God is love." Of course, love is one of those ideas that you have to use your imagination to fill in, because it's an abstract concept. How do you define love? What is meant by love? It brings out different ideas in our mind. So what they even mean by "God is love," we have to explore. Others might simply respond, "God is a myth." In other words, when they think about God, they come up with an idea in their mind that God is a non-reality concept. There's no reality there. Or maybe they imagine a Godfather time type idea, some old man with a long beard that's wise and just sits there in the heavens looking over things. The point is that everyone will imagine God in some fashion. When we think about God, we will imagine Him some way. Now, I hope that we all recognize that the important thing is that we are continually refining our imagination of God. We must refine our imagination of God so that it becomes increasingly true to His reality. God exists. We are not free to imagine Him however we choose. He is a real being, a real person. So we must refine our imagination of God so that what we imagine in our minds matches the reality of who He is. Our chapter this morning should help us do that. If we allow our thinking to be corrected by Jesus in the areas that He addresses, Jesus is going to address a number of areas that affect the imagination of God. And we need to be corrected as necessary. As I read, we're in this chapter 12 of Mark's Gospel, and we're actually this morning looking at the final public teaching of Jesus. This is the last time that Jesus speaks publicly before His trial. We're in the middle of His final week in Jerusalem, and Mark now hasn't given specific time frames for the last chapter or so we cannot pin down exactly which day of the week we're on. It's probably either Tuesday or Wednesday, depending on if there's a break somewhere in here. Jesus has been coming to the city of Jerusalem every day after he entered on Palm Sunday. He entered the temple, and he's found large crowds every day. There's crowds there because we're approaching the Passover, one of the three great celebration times where the entire nation would come and worship God. So there's large crowds accumulating in the temple area, and Jesus has been quite popular with these crowds. They've enjoyed his teaching. They've been listening to him. But he has not been popular with religious leaders. The leaders are becoming increasingly determined that they need to find a way to bring Jesus' teaching to a very dramatic and drastic end. He must be stopped. Yet, as we've seen numerous times, they fear the crowd. In other words, things are progressing toward the crucifixion. And the events of this chapter will play their part in that progression. This morning, though, I don't want to focus on that progression. Rather, the focus of this chapter itself is on the teachings of Jesus and the way in which he's correcting various people who were imagining God in their minds, but they were imagining him wrongly. In fact, the core issue between the religious leaders and Jesus was that Jesus was calling the God of their imagination a false God. He was doing this by repeatedly stating that they really did not know God. And by correcting their teachings about God, what he was telling them is the God you've created in your mind is not God. You're imagining a false God. Now that should scare us this morning. If the religious leaders of Jesus' day could have a false God in their imagination, we can too. We must allow Jesus to correct our imagination of God. That's the main idea this morning in our chapter. That's the idea that needs to captivate our mind and guide us as we work our way through this chapter. We must allow Jesus to correct our imagination of God. There are at least six things about God that are on display through the events and the teachings in these 44 verses. Again, because we're covering the whole chapter, we will not dive deeply into any of these areas, but we will try to allow Jesus to correct our imagination of God in each of these six areas. We must allow Jesus to correct our imagination of God. And by now, hopefully the kids have picked up that's the thing to fill in the blank on their sheet. We must allow Jesus to correct our imagination of God. In the first 12 verses, Jesus teaches about God's absolute authority. God's absolute authority. As Jesus begins telling the story that's recorded here in the first 11 verses, it's likely that the them he refers to in verse 1 are the same leaders that he rebuked in the end of the previous chapter. There had been that delegation from Sanhedrin that was trying to figure out who gave you the authority to speak like this. They'd refused to answer Jesus' question regarding authority, but it's probably the same people that are still there. Because the point of this story is dealing with religious leaders, and it would not have taken this delegation from the Sanhedrin very long to figure out that Jesus is casting them into the role of the tenants in this story he tells about this vineyard. Jesus is making use of a common situation of their day. Because they were under Roman occupation, it was very common that the actual land itself would be owned by people who were not present. They were owned by people in Rome. The land was owned by a lot of Roman royalty or high-level people, upper-class society, or people that lived in Rome or some other major city. Most of the land was managed by tenants. Essentially, they were sharecroppers. They were allowed to live on the land. They could work the land. But they had to provide a portion of what the land grew to the landowner each year. And that was usually collected by a servant that was sent for that purpose. So Jesus is structuring this story in a typical scenario that they'd be familiar with. At the same time, he's pulling from the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, Israel was often referred to as God's vineyard. And the prophets were often described in the Old Testament as servants. For that reason, it's pretty simple here for the leaders, as well as the general crowd that would have been listening, to figure out that God was the owner in the story, and the tenants, those who humiliated the servants and beat the servants and killed the servants, that those were the religious leaders, because the leaders had rejected prophets throughout the nation's history. Yet as Jesus developed the story here, he employed an additional legal element of the day. In that day, if a piece of land became unclaimed, if there was no living ownership to claim the land, then it could be acquired by the occupants. Those who were working the land could lay claim legally to it. In Jesus' story, the tenants assumed that the arrival of the son represented that the owner himself was no longer alive, that the son now is the only heir. So they thought they could acquire the land by killing the only living owner. Of course, in the story, the tenants are very wrong. And by this point, Jesus has made his point. Jesus is claiming to be the son of the rightful owner. He is claiming to be the son of the rightful owner of the vineyard, which is Israel. He is claiming to be the son of God. And the leaders, he's pointing out, are plotting the same type of evil deed as the tenants in the story by seeking his death. At the same time, he's warning them, you're about to make an error just like the tenants in the story. An error in calculation, because the rightful owner is very much alive. And God will judge their actions severely, part of which will be giving Jesus the place of highest honor. Jesus is calling leaders out here for imagining a God who they could ignore, a God whose servants could be humiliated and killed, a God whose son could be slain, and a God who would not be able to address it. But the God of their imagination was not God. God has absolute authority. The only rightful response that they could offer God would be bow before him, and that necessarily would mean bowing before his son, Jesus. Let me ask you, how about you? In your imagination, is God one with absolute authority? Or do you respond to him like these leaders, rejecting those that he has sent? You know that every time we ignore what's in this book, we're responding just like the leaders. We're rejecting the one God has sent. And we are rejecting his son if we refuse to bow before him. The God of our imagination, if we allow Jesus to correct us, will be a God of absolute authority. Real belief accepts God's absolute authority. We must allow God to correct our imagination of God. Moving on from God's absolute authority, in verses 13 through 17, Jesus teaches us about God's absolute ownership. He was the owner of the vineyard, but he is the absolute owner. It's hard to say, as I mentioned, whether all the events in this chapter occur in the same day. We don't have careful markings at this point of the week. But Mark has arranged these without any time breaks, indicating at the very least there's a connection in the ideas. There's an interconnectedness between the conflicts with the religious leaders and Jesus at this time. In verse 13, we have some Pharisees and Herodians approach Jesus. They approach with very flattering words, but we're told their goal is to trap Jesus. They're using a word that means they're coming with a goal of deception and treachery. And Jesus immediately sees through it. He knows. They're simply using that to try and trap him. On the surface, they simply ask Jesus a question. Seems like a very simple question on the surface. Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? Now, they're referencing a very specific tax, a tax that has been in place for about 25 years, a poll tax. It was imposed in AD 60, and it had to be paid with a coin that bore the image of the emperor. It was a tax that had to be paid annually with that coin. Many of the Jews hated this tax. They hated the coin itself because that coin had the image of the emperor. And in their mind, having the image of the emperor on that was a form of idolatry. And then on the other side of the coin, there was always an inscription. And the coins varied based on who was the emperor at the moment, but it would usually be an inscription something like, at this particular time, the most current coin would have been Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus. In other words, it was a statement that implied the emperor was divine. So the Jews hated the coin itself, let alone the reminder that they're under Roman occupation. That's the reason they had to pay it. So the question that was asked here is a tricky question. The question was designed to make Jesus either give an answer that would be very unpopular with the people. If he says, pay the toll, the people would hate that. But if he went the other direction and said, refuse to pay the toll, now he's being treasonous from a Roman perspective. So it was not a harmless question. Yet, once again, we see that those who tried to trap Jesus are no match for Jesus. He calls for a coin, using a word that theologically, immediately would connect them back to the creation account of Genesis. He asks, whose likeness, or more specifically, whose image is on this coin? That precise word, image, whose image is this? That ties them right back to the creation account, where in Genesis 1:27, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. He says, whose image is this? Of course, they knew whose it was. They knew the coin. They said, Caesar's. So Jesus says, render, or pay. Pay what is owed to Caesar, the thing that are his. And to God, the things that are God's. They understood that Jesus was saying, give these coins to Caesar if he has a rightful claim to these coins. And it was actually considered that the coin bore his image because he owned the coin. It was just being lent out to his subjects, his citizens. So if he has a claim to it, pay him that coin, but give to God those who have his image. All of yourself is owned by God. God can lay absolute claim to all of you. Here again is an area that we need some correcting in our imagination of God. We do not want to imagine a God who has absolute authority, absolute ownership over us. Why can't I say that? Because we all at times complain about situations that God brings us into. Yet if God has absolute ownership for us, we have no reason to complain. He can do what he wants with our life. We all tend to pick and choose which portions of God's commands we want to follow and when we want to follow them. I will give God Sunday morning, but I own the rest of my week myself. I will read my Bible for 5 minutes every morning, but I will not fill in the blank. We all have areas of our lives where we do not give God absolute ownership. And yet God has absolute ownership. We need to correct our imagination of God. We need some correction there before he will have absolute ownership over us. God's absolute ownership. We must allow Jesus to correct our imagination of God. Now the way I'm going to describe Jesus' teaching in verses 18 through 27 is God's absolute otherness. His absolute otherness. In these verses, we have another attempt to trip up Jesus. This time, it's a group of Sadducees. This is the first time we've come upon this group in Mark. If you remember several years back when we went through the Gospel of John, we learned that these Sadducees are primarily a liberal political party. They were noted for cooperating with the Roman occupation. For that reason, most of the high priests came from the Sadducees party. Rome was good with this group. From a religious perspective, though, they were quite conservative because they rejected all of the oral traditions of the Pharisees. That's why the Sadducees and Pharisees were so often at odds with each other. Now, they set this story before Jesus that's based on the Old Testament law of the levirate marriage, in which a brother of a deceased man is obligated to marry the man's wife if the man did not produce any children prior to death, so that a child could be raised up in the name of the brother, and that all the property that the brother would have owned would be kept within the family, within that tribe. It was a law to retain the rights of the family. It's possible that the Sadducees used this story in their debates with the Pharisees frequently. It seems like, just the way it's presented, a well-developed story. They talk about this man who's married. He dies without children. His brother marries the widow. However, the second brother also dies without leaving any children behind. Third brother marries her, and the sequence goes on and on until we have seven brothers, all dying without any children being born. If you think about it, their question really didn't require more than the first two brothers. But seven in their mind made their question more convincing. They thought made the whole idea that they're about to throw it out here as being one of utter absurdity. Whose wife will this woman be in the resurrection? The Sadducees were told actually denied that there would be a resurrection, but they thought this scenario demonstrated how ridiculous the idea of a resurrection was. In verse 27, Jesus castigates them for two fundamental mistakes. They did not understand the scriptures, and they did not understand the power of God. In other words, the God that they imagined in their mind was not God. They imagined God, and by extension, any future system that God would set up would be very much like the current system. It would just be a continuation of some kind, because God was going to be just like them at some level. But God is not at all like us. And the eternity that God has laid out on the other side of the grave is totally unlike our current situation. By the way, Jesus does clearly state the Sadducees are wrong about their view about the resurrection. He clearly says God will raise the dead. The situation here is that the Sadducees is one where they don't understand God's absolute otherness. God is not like us. God has absolute otherness. A very common mistake throughout human history is to imagine God like ourselves. Take the Greek mythology just as one example. All the Greek gods have strengths and weaknesses that are very much like humans. They have all the same fickleness as humans. They're just stronger, more powerful, live forever. But all the common whims that they have are just like humans. The common perspective of God among Americans today is not much different. We say we've progressed from days of mythology, but God that's imagined by the average American is not much different. People imagine that if they believe a certain action or a certain lifestyle is okay, well, then God must believe that too. They're just creating a God that fits their own imagination. We must resist fervently, even furiously, that kind of thinking. God is absolute otherness. He is not like us. Our imagination must embrace this before we will ever begin to imagine God in our minds as he really is. We must allow Jesus correct our imagination of God. We must allow Jesus correct our imagination about God's absolute otherness. In verses 28 through 34, moving on, we find God's absolute demand. His absolute demand. I really wish we had time to slow down and look more fully at these verses, especially this section. This is the only time in the entire Gospel of Mark where Jesus encounters a friendly scribe. The only time. There has to be other scribes that were somewhat friendly, but this is the only one we have record of. So it leads to a very different exchange between Jesus and this man from all the other interactions Jesus had with leaders. Again, Jesus is asked a question. The scribes, the religious leaders of the day, they had identified over 613 separate commands in the law. And then they'd gone on and they divided up these commands between heavy commands and light commands. In other words, really important commands and things that are less important. One of their favorite intellectual exercises as scribes was to sit around and discuss whether or not the law could be summarized in a single command. And of the 613, they also liked to discuss which was the most important command. The scribe here is simply asking Jesus to weigh in on this ongoing discussion. But he's not doing it in a manner trying to trip Jesus up. He's just asking for his opinion. And for that reason, Jesus gives a straightforward answer. He says the most important one is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord," and so forth. This is the command that was called the Shema by the Jews. The Shema, it was cited by an obedient Jew twice a day. It was what they would put in their little tassel box or on their head. Their phylacteries were hanging, and they'd put that little box on. They'd put this on because they want it written on their person. It was their main command in their eyes. And it came from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, that Dale read to us earlier. And it was called the Shema simply because Hebrew, the word for hear that starts the command is Shema. So it was just a shortcut to hear. Where we'd hear, "Hear, O Lord," or "Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord." But then Jesus goes on and he says, loving God completely is the most important, and that's followed by the command from Leviticus 19:18 to love your neighbor as yourself. The scribe appreciated the answer and recognized that Jesus is emphasizing that the God desired a heart that's given entirely over to him, rather than a formal set of actions. Most of the commands dealt with a bunch of actions that you had to do or not do. But what God really desires is a heart that's given over to him. And he also recognized that it's impossible to really love God without loving others. One cannot love in the abstract without loving in the concrete. We cannot have an abstract love for God who we cannot touch and feel, we can only imagine, if we have no love for people that we can see and touch and feel and interact with. We must love in the concrete before we can love in the abstract. Jesus looked at the scribe here and he told him that he was not far from the kingdom of God. After all, there really is not much difference between loving God and trusting God. The scribe recognized what was required to truly love God, yet he still was not trusting God completely because he did not trust in Jesus. Well, I hope we can see from this very quick pass-through of this encounter with the scribe is that close to belief is not good enough. It's still unbelief. God's demand is absolute. He requires our whole committed love, a committed love that produces a whole committed love for others, a committed love that's intimately connected with Jesus Christ. We cannot love God without trusting in Jesus. That tells us that we dare not imagine a God who will accept us without placing our faith in Jesus. We cannot imagine a God who will be tricked by all the religious actions that we may go through. That's what Jesus is really pointing out here by setting all the other commands aside. God won't be tricked. The real God will not be tricked by religious actions if we're not wholeheartedly devoted to him. The God we imagine must be a God who demands our total commitment to him and to others. That's the God of the Bible. God's absolute demand. We must allow Jesus to correct our imagination of God. Now, the next section is only 3 verses long, but in them we learn about God's absolute superiority. His absolute superiority. It doesn't seem as if Jesus is necessarily continuing his discussion with the scribe that he was just talking to, but he does correct the understanding of scribes in general. Seems like the one scribe, his imagination of God was pretty good, but the scribes in general had a wrong view of God that resulted in a very wrong view of the Messiah. As the true Messiah, Jesus now initiates the question. We're told that no one else dares ask him any questions at this point. So Jesus initiates. He asks, how is it that the Messiah can be the son of David when David calls him Lord? In the ancient society in which David lived in, a father would never call his own son Lord. And he certainly would not do that for someone that was further descendant than his immediate son. A father just would not do that. Yet that is what David did in Psalms 110:1 that Jesus quotes there in verse 36. And the only possible conclusion that can be made is that David prophetically knew that the Messiah would be much more than a simple physical descendant of his. David knew that the Messiah would be vastly superior to himself. This is a very quick section, but it can again inform us of the importance of proper imagination. When the scribes imagined the Messiah, they did not imagine someone greater than King David. David was the pinnacle in their mind. Rather, they imagined the Messiah as someone that would be like David and their kingdom to the level that David had. Their imagination of the Messiah was flawed. The real Messiah was so much more. The real Messiah was the Son of God, and that made him infinitely greater than David. And as the Son of God, the Messiah displayed the absolute superiority of God. Again, this has to be factored into our imagination of God. His absolute superiority. God is absolutely superior. Is that the way you picture him when you imagine him? If we're honest with ourselves, I think we have to say at times that is not the God we imagine. There are times when the people in front of our eyes are imagined to be superior to God because we don't tell them about God. If we think that they might not like to hear, we withhold the gospel because we think these people are more important than God. Or we walk away, or we fail to walk away maybe is more like it. We fail to walk away from a group when we know they're doing things that God disapproves of because we think they're superior to God. We give in to peer pressure. This is wrong imagination of God. And you know, this kind of wrong imagination of God works out even in the church setting. I'll step on toes now. There's times where we are afraid to pray out loud in a group. We're demonstrating that in our imagination at that moment, God is not absolutely superior. A potential smirk or the thought that might go through somebody else's mind when they hear us pray is superior to what we think of God. Like the scribes of Jesus' day, we must allow Jesus to correct our imagination of God. His absolute superiority must be part of a corrected imagination of God. Lastly, the final two sections, to me, seem to point to one last aspect of God that we need to factor into our imagination. God's absolute awareness. His absolute awareness. In verses 38 through 40, Jesus uses a negative example. He uses negative example of scribes who specialized in self-promotion. They did all sorts of things to direct attention to themselves and to gain honor for themselves. They loved to strut around and show how important they were. They really didn't care if they had to play a little bit underhanded behind the scenes, in the background, as long as they were important in front of people. It was less important if people like widows were hurt than that they were elevated. What mattered was that they were seen as important, honored people. Now, let's not think for a moment that we're not prone to behave the same way. I think a simple review of most of our Facebook accounts would prove otherwise. We're all prone to do things at times to generate the praise and acclaim of others. The skill of humble brag is alive and well. Humble brag simply means when we say things like, I'm humbled that I would be given an opportunity to be so great. And a lot of times that's what it boils down to. By contrast, in verses 41 through 44, Jesus points out a widow who brought her offering to the temple. The temple at that time contained a number of boxes in the court that were marked according to where the funds would go. And people would bring their gifts in, and they'd drop their offerings into these boxes. And some would go for purchasing sacrifices. Some would go to service of the temple. Different functions. And Jesus sat there and observed how people were bringing in sizable amounts and placing them into the various boxes. And then this woman came, and she placed in two small coins. The Greek actually names the exact coins that were used. They were the lepton. That was the smallest coin in circulation in Palestine at the time. And in fact, apparently this coin, lepton, wasn't even used in Rome. That's why Mark gives a conversion table for his readers in Rome. He translates and says it's equivalent to this. Two of them are equivalent to this. It's to help out. Unfortunately, coins are notoriously hard to translate. So that leads to expressions like we have in the King James of a mite, or we have here in the New American Standard of a cent. Probably the easiest way to think of these coins is that this lepton was the equivalent to about 10 to 15 minutes worth of work for a general laborer. In other words, a small amount. By today's standards, maybe you could think about the two coins that she put in together would add up to about a Big Mac. And that's the rate of what she put in. Yet the point that Jesus makes is that this widow put in more than all the others, because these two coins represented her entire net worth. She had given all that she had. Of course, there are a lot of applications that we can make in these last two statements, but the point I want us to take away today is the implication is that in both cases, God was absolutely aware of what was going on. God knew what the scribes were up to when they were strutting around. God knew what the widow was up to when she put in her coins. God knew. God even knew when the scribes were standing there giving long prayers that other times there were cheating widows. God knew. Do we factor the absolute knowledge of God into our imagination of Him? If we did, we would probably be a whole lot more careful about a whole lot of things. We'd be a lot more careful about what we watch, what we put in front of our eyes. We'd be careful about what we do in secret. We would be careful about our motivation even for what we are doing in public. We would be asking ourselves, why are we doing this? What is behind it? What is motivating us? We would even be completely unconcerned about the times when we do things for others that are not noticed, because we would know that God knew. We would think and behave differently if we regularly imagine God as having absolute awareness. We need Jesus to once more correct our thinking. We need Him to correct our imagination. We must allow Jesus to correct our imagination of God. We must consider God's absolute awareness. As I've been saying all along, imagination is the way that we conceive of God. But our imagination must be ruthlessly, biblically informed. We must allow Jesus to correct our imagination. In this chapter here, it's filled with Jesus' final public teaching. We've seen six things that must be included in a biblically informed imagination of God. God's absolute authority, God's absolute ownership, God's absolute otherness, God's absolute demand, God's absolute superiority, and God's absolute awareness. We cannot allow ourselves to create a God of our own imagination. That's idolatry. We must continually refine the God that we hold in our imagination by God's own revelation of Himself. We must allow Jesus to correct our imagination of God. Let's pray.